friends, I would like to start with where have we come from? Because I think that's where the story begins. And the story begins a long time ago, many, many years before the society was founded. The plan was evidently there. And Madame Blavatsky fitted that plan and was prepared to take part in it very much earlier on. Those of you who have read biographies of her life will know that as a child she was very psychic, she had a lot of visions, she was a very peculiar girl, very difficult I think for all those in her family amongst whom she grew up. And amongst the many things that were very, very real to her, however, although she could never prove it, was the existence of a personage who appeared to her from time to time, sometimes when she got into troubles, and helped her, and she felt, without knowing who it was, that this was a sort of guardian angel, and she had an enormous affection and respect for him. He was an Indian, wearing Indian clothes and a turban. You can imagine, therefore, her joy and surprise when, quite a few years later, she was in London with her father, and it was on the occasion of one of Queen Victoria's jubilees, and there was a big procession through the streets of London, and there she saw, riding amongst a whole group of Indian princes, the personage of her visions or her dreams. To cut a long story short, they met in Hyde Park the following day, and then for the first time she realized that she was in the presence of her guru, of her master, and from that moment on he took charge of her life. And he sent her all over the world. You find her in remote places, in Tibet even at his ashram, in South America, riding dressed as a man on horseback, through very wild and rather uncivilized places. You find her in Egypt, North America, Europe, all over the world, collecting, everywhere she could find it, information about religions and cults and legends and myths, old wives' tales, if you like, from everywhere, which finally appeared in her book, Isis Unveiled, showing, as she was instructed to try to show, with references and proofs, that all these things stemmed from one and one source only. And so she was directed to America in 1873, and there she met Colonel Alcott, also by design, and finally together they founded the Theosophical Society. It was started under that name in November 1875 in New York. It wasn't in the first place really a brotherhood society. It was founded very much more to investigate, according to our third object, the unexplained laws of nature, and to put before the West some of the teachings of the Oriental religious philosophy. And it was really only a number of years later that brotherhood as such became the first and most important object of the society. But it was clear from the beginning that this was the aim of those who were behind Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Alcott, because it is made clear in their communications. Now, if you are joining any kind of group, society, or organization, you probably feel that you would like to know something about it. You would like to know what it is for. You would like to know something of its terms of reference. And I feel that we should also be concerned with the terms of reference, as it were, of this society. And to whom should we look for those terms of reference, if not to those who inspired Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Alcott to found the society? Truly, our founders were left very much to their own devices. They had to work for what was called sometimes a forlorn hope, and could not rely on being told exactly what to do and how to do it, every 2 minutes by those who were behind them. They were left to find their own way, to make their own mistakes, and to make their own successes as best they could. But in the background, hovering as it were with goodwill and compassion and guidance from the perhaps mental realm, were those elder brothers referred to in our literature as KH and M. And we have so many of their letters. There are many of their letters, as you know, in the British Museum, and we have a considerable number of such letters also at Adyar. And again and again you find such quotations as this: the chiefs want a brotherhood of humanity, a real universal fraternity started. And on another occasion, the term universal brotherhood is no idle phrase. Humanity in the mass has a paramount claim upon us. That's the Adept Brotherhood. It is the only secure foundation for universal morality. If it be a dream, it is at least a noble one for mankind, and it is the aspiration of the true adept. Rather perish the society with both its hapless founders than that we should permit it to become no better than an academy of magic or a hall of occultism. And again, human and purely individual personal feelings, blood ties, friendship, patriotism, race predilections, all will give way to become blended into one universal feeling, the only true and holy one, the only unselfish and eternal one, love, an immense love for humanity as a whole. For it is humanity which is the great orphan, the only disinherited one upon this earth. And it is the duty of every man who is capable of an unselfish impulse to do something, however little, for its welfare. Poor, poor humanity. HPB follows up by saying this: true evolution teaches us that by altering the surroundings of the organism, we can alter and improve the organism. And in the strictest sense, this is true with regard to man. Every theosophist, therefore, is bound to do his utmost to help on, by all the means in his power, every wise and well-considered effort which has for its object the amelioration of the condition of the poor. That calls us, it seems to me, to consider, not ourselves but others, whether you like to interpret poor in the literal sense that people have no money, or to look upon it in the other sense that they are, how shall I say, poor in their understanding of life. It at least means that we have to go out. We are not intended just to sit and wait like spiders in a web for poor hapless flies. We are expected to go out to the world and make it known that theosophy exists, that there is a way, that there is a path of return, and that anyone who wants can start if he really wants to do so. Madame Blavatsky frequently used the word philanthropy and philanthropist and altruism, and she used them as synonyms for theosophy. Frequently she used one or the other. A theosophist is inevitably, in her view, a philanthropist or an altruist, someone who is doing things for other people, not just doing things for himself. So let us try and realize why this thing started. And it seems to me very clear that it was started to help other people. Perhaps the best known letter that we ever received is the one received called the Mahachohan's letter, received in 1881. And there again, this is made very clear. For our doctrines to react practically on the so-called moral code, let me just say so-called, because our moral code is a moral code of the 1970s, so to speak. It isn't an eternal moral code. It was different 100 years ago, it would be different 100 years from now. And so they say the so-called moral code, because what we have today is not the end or the final or not even necessarily the best. It simply happens to be the moral code that was accepted in the world of 1977. And so the elder brother can well write on the so-called moral code. In order for our doctrines to react, therefore, on the so-called moral code, we have to preach and popularize a knowledge of theosophy. We have to preach and popularize. And that means you and me, not somebody else over there, but we, who are the members of the Theosophical Society. We have to preach and popularize. That doesn't mean, as I said before, just sitting and waiting. It means going out and doing something, as everybody else does who preaches and popularizes. We shall have to find our own way of doing it. We don't want to vulgarize it. We don't want to go in for things that are undignified of the great and ageless wisdom. But we have to go out, nevertheless, to a world which today is crying out on all sides for the kind of food that we have to offer. Have we the right to say any longer, as so many say, when they're ready for theosophy, they'll come to us? Haven't you heard people say that? I've heard them say it all over the place. Of course, it's true in a way. If somebody really wants it, they'll go on looking for it. Why should we make it so difficult for them? Why shouldn't we open our doors and make it easier for the millions today who are seeking for just what we have to give? If they don't like it, they won't stay very long. But there will lots of people who will come who are just looking for what we have to offer, looking for our libraries, looking for our books, looking for our kindly people who are willing to help them. I'll go on with this paragraph. It is not the individual and determined purpose of attaining nirvana for oneself, that culmination of all knowledge and absolute wisdom, which is, after all, only an exalted and glorious selfishness. I didn't say that. It is one of the elder brothers who says that. Seeking nirvana for ourselves is nothing less than an exalted and glorious selfishness. It is the self-sacrificing pursuit of the best means to lead our neighbor onto the right path, to cause as many of our fellow creatures as we possibly can to benefit by it, that constitutes the true theosophist. It couldn't be clearer, could it? We are not here just for ourselves. We are here to be part of the instrument whereby the world can be helped. We're all part of it. That's why we should, as it were, work together as a brotherhood, because those that work together in a brotherhood can become a more useful instrument in the hands of those who started the society. So we look at these, our terms of reference, and it seems to me we have to take them rather seriously in the world of today. It does not mean that we have not taken them seriously, but the world of yesterday was the world of yesterday, and what we did in 1925 may have been perfectly right in 1925. But it is not right, in my opinion, to do in 1975 or 1977 what was the right thing in 1925. Do we think the world has stood still? It hasn't stood still, has it? Isn't it an entirely different place from 100 years ago or from 50 years ago? Of course it is. Are we just sitting still? We have to protect the principles which are eternal. We don't have to reduce them or lower them in any way. But we have to find a way of presenting them, of reaching the people of the world, because we are here to reach the people of the world. That's what we're here for. That's why we've earned the right to come here, it seems to me. Now, we are described sometimes as ambassadors. What is an ambassador? Ambassador is somebody who is considered sufficiently knowledgeable about his country to be able to represent it effectively in some other country. And he is also considered to be someone who knows, or at least can know, sufficient about the country to which he's accredited that he can be a good ambassador to that country. Now, if we are ambassadors, then we have to know our country and the other country. And our country is the Theosophical one. We have to know, as I've already said, something about theosophy. We have to pursue studies, discuss, share ideas, think, meditate, do many things, but to find out for ourselves, and not only at second hand, what theosophy is really all about. And to do that, we must study. And we would be wise, it seems to me, initially, to find out what the origins of the society really were. Irrespective of how wonderful everybody else may have been in these last 100 years, we have to go back and find out also how it started. And not be afraid. We have to go back with an open mind to see actually what was said, what the elder brothers put forward with regard to the teaching, regard to the great ageless wisdom about the universe, about the world, about man, about his character, where he came from, where he's going, his purpose, and so on. We don't have to be afraid, but we have to look. And perhaps some of us need to look again. I feel that with regard to myself at all times, and it may perhaps possibly apply also to some of you. It would be very good for most of us to take one of the earlier books, like, for instance, Kowalski's Key to Theosophy, and try and see what is said there. It's good for us to get that background. Whatever else we may have studied, and whatever else we're going to add to it, we ought to know how it started. Then we have to know the world to which we're accredited. If we're going into the center to gain experience of whatever sort, either intellectual knowledge through study or a deeper experience, sort of through study in another sense, towards something deeper in terms of consciousness, then we must also share it. The only purpose of studying is that we should have more to share. I suggest that must be true under the law of the Bodhisattva. Then, whatever we have realized within ourselves, in terms of wisdom or light, whatever you like to call it is in order that we may help the other person on the circumference to find his way to that very same experience. Not to keep to ourselves, not to prate about it, but being essentially humble. Because if one knows anything at all, I'm not pretending to, if one knows anything at all of the light, one knows how little of it one has seen, compared to how much there is. So one must be humble as one goes to the circumference, as it were, to try and offer what one has to help other people. So I feel that the ambassador, therefore, which we all are, has a work to do. He's got to look to his studies, to his background, and represent his country, which is theosophy, and go out to the world, and he's got to know the world. How can you help it if you don't know it? How can you do anything useful in any field at all if you don't know your field? You can only make matters worse, make muddles, make difficulties, make chaos even. So we have to know the world we're in, not turn our backs on it, or pick and choose some little bit which happens to fit us for the moment and neglect all the rest. It is the whole world we have to go to, as best we can, using some discrimination, obviously, but nevertheless not rejecting opportunities because they are new or because they are difficult. And the world needs theosophy. It has a tremendous need in this age where there are so many organizations mushrooming around us everywhere, some of which may be quite good and some probably are not so good. People leave them often enough to come to theosophy. We have that experience in many places, because they have not really found what they were looking for. We have to try and make theosophy available. Make it available, not shut up in a lodge room somewhere. Make it available to the world. We have to do something more about books. We have something more about magazines, something more about libraries, making libraries available to the people. In many, many cities where there are lodges of the Theosophical Society, there is probably no library in that city which is as good as the lodge library with regard to to all these things which interest a theosophical student. And yet, very often, we don't allow the public to borrow any books. Is that brotherly? Brotherly to ourselves, yes, because we don't want to lose our books. Brotherly to ourselves, who are we thinking about? We're thinking about ourselves. We're not thinking about them. Every library loses books. Why should we think that we won't lose any? Of course we shall lose some books. But if we are sensible and business-like, and we charge perhaps a few cents, or whatever you call it, especially for the books that are rarer and so on, we shall have a little fund, and if we lose a book, we can buy another. Every library runs like that. We could do it too in every lodge. It means getting people to work. It means getting people to be at the library every day, at hours when it suits the public, not hours when it suits us, at hours when it suits the public, so the public can come. It is they who are our orphan humanity that we are here to help, while at the same time we help ourselves. Has it not been said again and again in our literature that the best way of growth is to forget yourself utterly in the service of others? And we've all heard it, but probably we often find it too difficult to do. And we therefore find our way, all too often, even members of our society, into all sorts of other groups that are offering something rather sensational in the way of progress. Why can't we accept in humility that the best way of growth is to forget yourself? It is only the personality that seeks sensations. Why are we not more conscious of the eternity of things and the eternity of our own nature? If any member is asked, what is a theosophist? Or what is a man, shall we say? What is a man? Most of us will answer eventually, one way or another, somewhat similar fashion. We'll say, well, you know, man is really a spirit. He really has his feet in the eternal nature of things, roots there. But he comes forth in incarnation and he wears bodies through which he can gain experience. But the bodies are not him. He wears bodies. He's really the spirit within. And it is a spirit that reincarnates throughout the ages, growing, 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 gathering experience until no longer has anything more to learn in this world school. We would all say something like this, probably. But you see, if it's really true, if we are that spirit, surely it must be the values, the priorities of that spirit which should guide our lives. Not the priorities of time. When we're faced with a problem, I mean, within reason, I can understand the difficulties, of course. But when faced with a problem, how many of us really, and I include myself in this, how many of us really think, now what is the best way to solve this problem from the point of view of the eternal nature of things? Totally apart from my personality. How many of us do that? I think it's very difficult to do, and I don't think we do it enough. But I fully believe, and I really think that we should be more concerned to take eternity seriously, rather than just talk about it, and not really take it very seriously in the long run. And more do I feel that this is our way, and it is by our representative, our representation of theosophy in ourselves that the future of the society is going to depend. It is how we are that people are going to judge both the society and theosophy itself. We have a tremendous responsibility to be this good ambassador for this greatest of all philosophies, referred to by that same elder brother. I must say, I'm not trying to criticize him because I wouldn't do that, but I must say it sounds very dogmatic. He starts off his letter by saying, the doctrine we promulgate, being the only true one, must, supported by such evidence as we are prepared to give, become ultimately triumphant as every other truth. Well, we have to perhaps accept that, but at the same time, not to be dogmatic, because nothing puts people off so much as dogmatic assertions. At the same time, we don't have to be weak. We don't have to be wishy-washy. We have to find our own way individually and as groups of presenting ideas in such a way that they are not presented dogmatically from the point of view of the person listening, but are presented from our side with a certain assurance and a certain, how shall I say, a certain faith, at least, in the truth of what we're talking about. So we need to pick up hints, I think, from our literature, and not be afraid of facing whatever the future brings. Duty is something which many people shun. Often duty means to many of us something a little painful, a little difficult, a little uncomfortable, and we don't often like to feel that something is our duty. But we have extracts from the writings of the elder brothers exalting duty. "My first duty," says Master K.H., "is to my master. And duty, let me tell you, is for us stronger than any friendship or even love. As without this abiding principle, which is the indestructible cement that has held together for so many millenniums, the scattered custodians of nature's grand secrets, our brotherhood, nay, our doctrine itself, would have crumbled long ago into unrecognizable atoms." And Master M., "I am as I was, and as I was I am, and always shall be, the slave of my duty to the Lodge and to humanity, not only taught to, but desirous of subordinating all preference for persons to my love for the human race." Now, what does one think of that? How far have we gone along that particular path? How much are we concerned to subordinate preference for persons to love for the human race? I dare say we're a long, long way behind. But this is one of those who inspired this society to which we belong. We might perhaps listen, therefore, to his view. If he is trying to do that, and he doesn't say he's done it, even he, as a master, he says he is trying, still, to subordinate all preference for persons to his love for the human race. Should we not also be trying? Hence brotherhood, and the opportunity it offers us in our lodges to love everybody, not the people we've chosen to love, which is easier for us perhaps, but everybody, even the most difficult from the point of view of the clash of character perhaps. We have to start. Duty is also very important. We are not working merely that people may call themselves theosophists, but that the doctrine we cherish may affect and leaven the whole mind of the century. This can be accomplished by an earnest band of workers who work for no human reward and no earthly recognition, but who, supported and sustained by a belief in that universal brotherhood of which our masters are a part, work steadily and faithfully in understanding, that's the studying, and putting forth for consideration, that's the making available, the doctrines of life and duty that have come down to us from time immemorial. Again, a very definite instruction as to what we're supposed to be about. Now we need to therefore, I think, look at our lodges and ourselves and try to see what might be done. First of all, I think we have to look from the point of view of the more negative side. And here I would like to quote from Dr. Besant, who had a very good aptitude of putting her finger right on the subject. "Our great danger, as HVB recognized, is the danger of getting into a groove. Who of us doesn't suffer from that danger? And so becoming fossilized in the forms of belief that many of us hold today. This will involve posterity in the same troubles which so many of us have had with regard to the teachings amongst which we were brought up." Many, many people, for us, for instance, in the Christian world, have had to make quite a struggle to get to a wider view. Doesn't mean that we have to give up our religion, but we have to look at it in a different way. We have to work towards a more universal view, a more living view of life. So we mustn't be fossilized. The society is and always has been intended to be a living body and not a fossil. And a living body grows and develops, adapting itself to new conditions. 1977. And if it is to be a body which is spiritually alive, it should be gaining continually a deeper and fuller view of truth. It is absurd for us to pretend at our present stage of evolution that we have arrived at the limits of knowledge it is possible for man to obtain. All of us are aware that our conceptions of truth are continually deepening. Nothing could be more fatal to a society like ours than to hallmark as true some special form of belief and then look askance at anyone who challenges it, trying to impose such beliefs on those who come after us. If the society is to live into the future, we must be prepared now to recognize freely and frankly that our knowledge is fragmentary, that it is partial, and that it is liable to very great modifications as we learn and understand better. Further, she says this, a shorter quotation, "The life of the Theosophical Society depends very, very largely on the encouragement that we give to thoughts which are new. However repugnant it may happen to be to some idea that we already hold, that we may cherish as being very noble. It is through fear of losing ideas that we cherish, which we have identified ourselves with, that we suppress freedom of thought." That's a tremendous statement, and I expect it hits nearly every one of us somewhere deep inside. It is a danger and a threat. "No true theosophist," here's a third one, "from the most ignorant to the most learned, ought to claim infallibility for anything he may say or write upon occult matters. The chief point is to admit that in many a way, in the classification of either cosmic or human principles, in addition to mistakes in the order of evolution, and especially in metaphysical questions, those of us who pretend to teach others more ignorant than ourselves are liable to err. So long as the artist is imperfect, how can his work be perfect? The search for truth is endless. Let us love it and aspire to it for its own sake, and not for the glory or benefit a minute portion of its revelation may confer upon us. For who of us can presume to have no whole truth at his fingers' ends, even upon one minor teaching of occultism?" Now, therefore, it seems to me we should look at ourselves, you see, and see if perchance, however much we may be trying to avoid it, perhaps there are parts of us which are in a groove, some way in our working which is in a groove, which may become a fossil if we're not careful. We have to get out of it while there's yet time. Not for ourselves only, for ourselves, yes, but for the sake of the mission of the Theosophical Society, for the sake of the world that we're supposed to help. We have absolutely no right to become a fossil. You see what I mean? I mean, it's utterly selfish to become fossilized in our way of thinking and working. Utterly selfish, because it means we're thinking about ourselves and we're not thinking about anyone else. We have a very, very real work to do, and it's a very serious one, and it requires a very definite commitment, a commitment such, perhaps, as only those can give who are really great in their nature. Take again Dr. Besant. I know I'm using a lot of quotations, but these quotations speak better for what I want to say than I could find words for myself. "I see that teachers and helpers are wanted in the visible and invisible worlds to instruct and aid humanity, and I offer myself to be evolved into such a teacher and helper at any cost of present or future suffering, in the swift breaking up of my lower nature, by any means which the masters in their wisdom deem to be the surest and swiftest, no matter how repugnant those means may be to my undeveloped understanding, along any roads, however stony and precipitous, which they may judge best for reaching the object in view. I give myself without reserve, seeking nothing, asking nothing, hoping nothing for the separated self. content to be in the light or in the dark, to be active or passive, to work or to wait, to speak or to be silent, to feel sorrow or joy. My only wish, to be what they need as an instrument for their mighty work. One day I suggest to you, you and I, every one of us, will have to make some such commitment. Perhaps we can't do it yet. We may be just little ones from that point of view. But one day, we may have to make such a commitment. And therefore it is interesting, it's interesting to oneself, as a matter of fact, to feel how far one can at this moment go in making that sort of commitment. How much can you really say of that, honestly, to yourself, knowing that you're able, not that you want, but that you're able to keep it? It's quite an interesting investigation into one's own self. And it isn't, as you can see, at all easy. You have to be rather a great person, perhaps, to make a great commitment or dedication such as that. But it's greatly inspiring, don't you think? It's inspiring to think that some of these people, with one obvious exception on the wall here, but all these people have been able to make this tremendous commitment. And it is because of their commitment, their utter dedication to this work and to those who brought the society into being, that we are here today. That's why, that's how it's been possible for us to be here. In all the many groups of theosophists of tomorrow and after tomorrow, we can help to make that possible by how we act with tremendous commitment and dedication now. This is a challenge to any member of the Theosophical Society at any time, but perhaps almost more so in this world that is so rapidly changing and which offers so many temptations to those who are seeking truth but don't know where they should go to find it. Now, I'm quoting a lot from Madame Blavatsky, but I'm doing it on purpose because she was, after all, the founder of the society, and I think that we need to know sometimes her way of putting things. And she was a very definite person in the sense that she did not compromise. She was not concerned with compromises. She was a black or white person, if you see what I mean. It was either like that or it was the other thing. It was not wishy-washy somewhere in the middle. But, and I don't mean by that that there isn't a middle way, because that's the middle way is not wishy-washy. As Madame Blavatsky herself suggests to us, the middle way may be defined, for instance, as a continued attempt to an attitude of mind to all existing things which is neither love, nor hate, nor indifference. Neither love, nor hate, nor indifference. I think that is a description of the middle way. We are not torn in that direction or pushed in the other direction. Nor are we indifferent, nor we say, well, I don't care. We are not indifferent. We care. We're interested. And we look objectively and impersonally, without emotion, to try and see how it is. And that has something to do, that isness of the moment is something to do, it seems to me, with the middle way. But she was absolutely unafraid of anyone. I mean, she was continually, as it were, punching people on the nose, metaphorically speaking. Possibly she actually did it. I don't know of any incidents, but she's quite capable of doing it, I'm sure, under sufficient pressure, because she was completely fearless. And so her statements are also very direct statements. The pivotal doctrines of the esoteric philosophy admit no privileges or special gifts in man, save those won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Not an invention, not a discovery, maleficent or beneficent, has ever been achieved by rituals, by reliance on miracles, or the offering up of sacrifice to some deity, human or otherwise. All that has been gained by work, by study, experiment, observation, and comparison. And this one is, these are all short quotations. And this one is prepared to devote to occultism his whole life. The superficial knowledge of occult sciences will lead him, surely, to become a target for millions of ignorant scoffers to aim their blunderbusses, loaded with ridicule and chaff against. If a man would follow in the steps of the Hermetic philosophers, he must prepare himself beforehand for martyrdom. He must give up personal pride and all selfish purpose, and be ready for everlasting encounters with friends and foes. He must part, once and for all, with every remembrance of his earliest ideas, on all and on everything. How far away are we from that? Can you part from all your earliest ideas on all and everything in order to start with a clean slate, as it were? Really, I'm mixing my metaphors very much, I'd say clean mirror, perhaps, to reflect the real truth undistorted of the great wisdom. See, what a lot is asked of us. And that's why it seems to me rather extraordinary that it can be said of us that we've earned the right to be here. What on earth did we do to earn this right? What on earth could it have been? But surely we must be busy again if we want to be in contact once more. Learn then well the doctrines of karma and reincarnation, and teach, practice, promulgate that system of life and thought which alone can save the coming races. Do not work merely for the Theosophical Society, but through it for humanity. And then from HPB's diagram of meditation, which you probably know, there are one or two things which seem to me so tremendously interesting. The perception in all embodied beings of limitation only. What wonderfully good advice. When you think of how we look at other people and complain about them, badger them, criticize them, gossip about them. We don't gossip or badger a poor acorn because it isn't an oak tree, do we? We know. It starts as an acorn, then it grows gradually and becomes an oak tree. We don't badger a bulb because it isn't already a tulip or a lily. Why should we badger each other? Because we're not already supermen. Why should we? But we do it all the time. And HPB says very wisely, don't do that. Regard all these perception in all embodied beings of limitation only. It's a limitation which will one day come into freedom. Just as the bulb will be the flower and the acorn the oak tree, so each one of us will flower one day into some glorious human superman. We're not that yet, but we're all on our way. Therefore, all the teaching becomes so much more sensible, doesn't it? That we should be concerned to help other people, not to criticize them, to be prepared to lend a hand, to really behave in a brotherly way towards everyone, no matter who or she may be, whether they be high or low, or rich or poor, stupid or clever, or anything else. That is the background of it, because everyone will one day be an oak tree, and we're still just little acorns breaking out of that seed. And she goes on to say, criticism without praise or blame. That's rather like the first one, isn't it? Just to see how it is. Sometimes we make comment. Not with praise or blame. Just try to see, objectively, dispassionately, what the position really is. And not immediately react in an excitable and emotional way to things that other people may say and do. And then she speaks of no distinction between friend and foe. No distinction. They're all teachers. They're all teachers. You may have to take different action. You can take it in a dispassionate way. You may have to. You may have to defend someone. But to regard the individual as your brother, even if he appears for the moment to be your foe. This is the challenge of theosophy, you see. It's frightfully difficult. Why should it be easy? The way that is offered to us is the way out of all this, into the freedom of being one with the universal self. Why should it be so easy as all that? It isn't. It is a difficult way. But we have got the chance now of trying to work in that direction. So let us be with it, in the rather modern sense of that expression, as our leaders were with it in the past. The greatest theosophists were tireless workers, positive, brave, competent, active, all the time. We may quote some ideas, but it is very probable, except when dealing with principles, that they wouldn't be saying exactly the same things today. If Madame Blavatsky came into this room, I wonder what she would think of you and me. I think she would get a big broomstick and sweep us all out, practically one and all. You know, because her standard was so high, a standard of conduct and behavior, and it's so high that most of us find it terribly hard, of course, to live up to it. But you see what I mean? She was such a power, and so she knew what she was doing. She knew what she was talking about. And she didn't suffer fools gladly, perhaps, in the strictest sense of that expression. You can't imagine them saying today exactly what they said so many years ago. They would be today in the forefront of the battle and very aware of the wiles of the enemy, because the enemy is always acting, subtly introducing apparent innocent harmlessness, in a way, into things which are perhaps not so good as they appear on the surface. And they undermine all true workers for truth. The values of these early members were always of the highest, and without any doubt at all, they would be in the thick of the fight today, proclaiming clarion calls and so on, calling out the membership to come and do this and do that, to take action, to take part. We don't seem to have so many people today. I won't say we don't have any, but we don't seem to have so many, although we have some, who are really issuing that sort of call to all of us to take part in what is happening. We mustn't isolate ourselves from the problems of today. We must try to understand them. Problems of people, especially the younger generation, they have tremendous problems today of violence. What are we doing about that? We have tremendous problems of sex. What are we doing about that? Tremendous problems of drugs. What are we doing about it? What are you and I doing about it? Probably we're not doing anything. Well, we may, I don't know. I don't know you all personally. But we tend, generally speaking, not to do enough about the problems of today. People want to know what to do when they're faced with these problems. Have we nothing to say? Has the great wisdom of theosophy no viewpoint at all, as it were, to put forward through its members, which could be helpful to those who are struggling with the problems of today? I'm sure we can do something. And I'm sure that HPB and Dr. Besant and Colonel Alcott and others, if they were here today, they would be doing that, because they were concerned with humanity and its problems. And we should have that concern, I feel, in the same way. So I feel, my brothers in the Theosophical Society, which is our work now, smaller people we may be, and we can say we are smaller people we are, but it's now in our hands. The torch, as it were, has been passed on to you and me, for better or for worse. The great opportunity, the great burden almost, you might say, the great responsibility has been passed on to you and me, and it is now you and I who have it. And so we must all, everywhere, somehow act to accept the challenge of today in order that our society may move strongly and successfully into the future, where it shall accomplish that for which it was put into the world. So we shall dedicate the years ahead once more, I hope, that built on the foundations of the past, we may carry out the great plan and work wherever we may be, so that the star of theosophical wisdom may continue to illuminate the paths of all our fellow men. So far as we're able to do that, we shall be doing, I hope, the Dharma for which we have come into this work. Thank you.